Come on, man. We need the work. Let's go. Let's go.
Got through on the field. He's got through. 35,
30. Want to get the puck. Rogan intercepted.
Touchdown, Giants.
Welcome to Big Blue Kickoff Live right here on Giants.com, 201-939-4513, or on Twitter if you prefer. You can get in touch with us at hashtag Giants Chat. That guy's Paul Dottino. I am John Schmelk. Happy to be back after a week off. Not a ton of news when I was away. Giants re-signing Daniel Fell, signing George Selvey. But the NFL offseason marches on here, Paul. And the news this week will be the owners' meetings that are happening. And Giants co-owner John Mara has already spoken to the media, so why don't we touch a little bit on some of these rule changes. And, of course, guys, if you want to call in, you want to talk about free agency, you want to talk about the draft, that's all fair game, but we have some news around the league, and this is stuff that could very well affect the Giants this season. So I think some of these things are very important to talk about. So, Paul, let's go going with some of the rule changes we've talked about in general.
You see, I thought that you were trying out at the veteran combine. I didn't know you went on vacation.
Well, you know what? Based on some of the 40 times that people said we're running that veterans combine, I might have done okay out there.
Mighty. The interesting part, and I do want to touch on that, John, just for one second,
yeah, sure,
if we can, because remember, it was Matt Burke, the former Viking center, who was kind of one of the coordinators of this, in the thinking that there are a lot of guys who may have fallen through the cracks, who may want to put their wares on display for all of the scouts one more time.
Yeah.
To maybe just give them that last gasp attempt at sticking in the NFL. And Darrell Scott, former Giants running back, was one of the guys who was there. In fact, he ran in the 4.7s, I believe, and had the fastest time among the running backs who were invited. There were about 100 players. And I found it very interesting because, John, it's a real indication of how badly some of these guys want to do it, because they had to pay all of their own expenses.
Right.
Plus, they had to pay a $400 entry fee to get on the field. I guess that's for insurance purposes.
I'm sure these players'
stuff.
Agents, though, would pay that for them.
I suppose, maybe. Right. But I guess what I'm saying is, you know, these guys, they're doing everything they can to hold on to the dream. And I think Pete Prisco of CBS, and I tweeted it out overnight, said that from talking to the scouts, it didn't look like there were going to be fewer than five, but no more than 10 guys who may get a contract to go to summer camp in a couple of months. And, you know, who knows how many of those guys will even wind up on 53s.
Well, look, I mean, these guys have put a lot of game film on tape already. So seeing them at a combine, you know, it's not like we're in college where you're trying to predict whether or not a guy can, you know, transfer his college ability to the pros. You know what these guys have done in the pros. So, you know, to me, the combine has much of a smaller significance.
And I agree. And I think that's what surprised me about the entire event because, you know, if I'm a player who has been a marginal player in the NFL, chances are my combine numbers are not going to get better a year or two after I've had a shot in the league. They're probably going to get worse.
Oh, yeah,
maybe
they're going to get worse, for
maybe,
sure.
Maybe if I really, really had something going on when I had my chance, maybe I can somehow improve it a tad. But a guy like that, a bubble player, to me, John, it's his intangibles that will help him get another job or stick in the league. It's not going to be a combine number. That's not going to help him. So I wonder what the validity is.
In fact,
it
might hurt some of these guys.
Yeah, I would think so.
Someone might think, well, this guy's a pretty good player. Let's say he's a veteran wide receiver. That's an ex-player. He's a 31-year-old veteran wide receiver that's had decent production in the league. He's been a possession receiver. He's been solid. He's a good blocker, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What happens if he goes to the combine and runs a 4.8 or a 4.7? You think that helps him?
Not at all.
Absolutely not.
So that's why I was curious, and I want, you know, that's why I really wanted to bring this up at the top, because this thing just happened yesterday. I mean, at first I thought it was a good idea, like, okay, fine, for the teams, they get to see a whole cluster of players and maybe somebody slipped through the cracks. But if you're a player, I'm not so sure that you're enhancing your chances by going to that thing.
I don't think you are either. And now the ownership meetings happen, and the NFL's done a good job of spreading all these things out now over a few weeks where they can, you know, really keep that NFL offseason in everybody's minds first and foremost.
I love it.
So,
okay.
And I guess the schedules are probably going to come out in a few weeks then, too, right? They're what, the third week of April usually?
Yeah, about a week or so before the draft. And as you guys know, the draft is now back into April this year out in Chicago. Well,
Partially in April.
First round,
in May.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And so, yeah, I mean, it's pretty amazing how the business calendar does keep the NFL alive.
All right, so let's talk about some of these rule changes that are being discussed at the owners' meetings, but I think a lot of them are interesting. And we'll talk about some that have been kind of talked about publicly, others that are kind of not on the forefront, but probably will get discussed in some of these competition committee meetings. Number one, and this isn't really a rule thing, this is more of a larger, you know, face of the NFL type of deal. There are going to be teams in Los Angeles in 2016, more likely than not,
in my opinion.
John Mara commented on that. I believe he said it was likely there would be a team in 2016,
at least one.
Right?
At least one.
And I think there are going to be two. What two they are between, you know, the Rams, the Chargers, and the Raiders. To me, I'm not sure if you want two teams in the same conference, in the same division, in the same city, which would make me, Chargers, Raiders, both of them together might be a little bit tough. I could see the Rams going back there, but my guess is we're going to have two teams in L.A. in a couple years.
Yeah, I would think so, John. You know, the funny part about it is, I think when we all first heard that the Giants and Jets were going to be partners in a stadium, everybody was like, well, you think you can really have two teams in one building? You know, it works. It may not be the best for everybody at all times, but it certainly is an efficient way to run a building.
Right, and it's certainly an efficient way to build a building, splitting the cost between two teams. And
no
that's
doubt.
The difference. Right now, the Chargers and Raiders have a plan to build a stadium together.
Yes.
The Rams' plan right now is a solo stadium, but I'm sure they would be willing, if the NFL mandates it, to share the building with somebody else if they have to.
The most interesting part to me when I saw all the reports coming out over the weekend about this, I guess, is it Kroenke's from the Rams who has the plan, the mock-up that I saw? It's like almost like a glass roof, like a big rectangular square kind of glass roof. It almost looks like a UFO or something. Very wicked. Very, very wicked. But I like it because it allows the light to get into the building, and at the same time, it does shield you from the elements. So it's pretty cool. Anyway.
All right, so Paul apparently, with his architectural genius here, supports the Rams bid to go to L.A. Another not necessarily a rule change, but something that could very well affect how the league functions every year is, you know, a couple years it was very hot to talk about whether or not you can expand the regular season.
Right.
That seems to have been pushed aside for now. We'll see if they eventually go back to it. They go back up to 18 games. But playoff expansion is now in the forefront.
Yeah.
And I happen to be against it. I like six teams. I'm a fan of, you know, having to work to get into the playoffs. But if you're going to expand it, I like this idea than some of the other ones I've seen thrown around, where you're adding two teams in each conference and things of that nature. Only adding one team and only giving your best team in each conference a bye, that to me is reasonable. I get it. You want to give another team a chance to make the playoffs, that's fine. But I will say this. I think this, if you're going to do it, is the only one that I would vote yes on.
And I would concur with that, John. One team per conference getting in as an extra wild card. The problem, as I understand it, that Commissioner Goodell was talking about yesterday is that they're trying to figure out how would they schedule that extra game, though.
Now, see, to me, I don't see why this is a big problem. Why can't you do a triple header on one of those days? You run triple headers on every Sunday during the NFL regular season. Why don't you run a game at 1, a game at 4:30, and a game at 8? Or on Saturday, there's already no game at 1 o'clock. So put the game at 1 o'clock on a Saturday. What's the problem?
I don't know, but he was talking about, I think the problem is you're going to want to have one of the other networks, and they're saying the Thursday night package is the package that's going to want the extra playoff game.
So that's fine. Have them get the one game at 1 o'clock on Saturday.
So, again, I don't understand all of the confusion, but his points were if you do a Thursday night game, now that causes scheduling conflicts because of advantages and disadvantages of having a game on an off day.
And same thing with Monday night.
Right.
You can't do that either.
Right.
Which is why you put a third game on the weekend.
Then they also, I think, said something about they were worried about NCAA conflicts.
And that's the Monday night situation with the national championship game.
Correct.
Which is fine.
So
like I said, play it on Saturday or Sunday.
You know, I don't know exactly what all the machinations are here, but I agree with John about this. One extra team per conference would not offend me. I'm not necessarily in favor of it, but it would not offend me.
Right. Because to me, you know, luck's the wrong word, but to me there's already, you know, a lot of momentum issues at the end of the year. The best team's not necessarily winning the Super Bowl every year. It's a team that gets hot at the right time. So I think the more teams you add, the more randomness you add to the situation. And sure. I think you want the regular season to count for as much as possible because that's the 16-game grind. That's what teams build for.
Absolutely.
And I want that to count for as much as possible.
I agree. And by the way, what do you think about the reseeding proposal? Now, that's another one, too, that's kind of out there. And that one doesn't get talked about
as much.
Which
one was that one?
There was one that said you would not necessarily give all the division winners the highest seeds right away because we've had division winners that had poor records. Mm-hmm. You know, you get a 500 team or – remember, a sub-500 team one year that made the playoffs because they won a division. One of the proposals
this year
is that,
too, NFC South.
Right. One of the proposals is that, guess what? We're going to seed, according to best record, overall in conference, and we're not going to give those division champions the benefit.
You know, I'm on the fence with that, to be honest with you. I could go either way. I get why you would want to make that rule change, but I also want to make the division important and make the division valuable because that, you know, if you don't make the division winners get home field, it makes the schedule more skewed because obviously the teams play most of their games within their own division, and a weakness or a strength there could then affect the rest of the games with how the teams are seeded. If teams, for example, in a very strong division, they win the division in 9-7, but they win it not in 9-7 because the other three teams are very, very good, then they have to travel to a 10-6 wild card team that's in a bad division that have two teams that are, let's say, 2-3 win teams. Is that fair to the 9-7 team that won the division in a very tough division? Probably not. So I'm kind of on the fence with that, to be honest with you.
I concur with you, but for a different reason. My reason is that basically when you go into a season, you know you're going to have X number of games in your division, and coaches will always tell you, we're worried most about our division games because
So
you're not only planning your schemes, your roster, everything about what you're doing, you're basing it off the core of your division and then the rest of the games. And I think it's wrong to then go with a seeding scenario that does not emphasize that because you've already told your coaches that, hey, you got to win your division first to guarantee a playoff spot. So I think that's a contradiction. So for that reason, I agree with you.
And I've seen some reports now that even if that does happen, the playoff expansion, probably not until 2016, not in 2015,
right.
From what the reports are saying. So whether those are true or not, who knows, but that's what people are saying out there. One rule that I think could get put in this year is some type of change in extra points. And I know you're a traditionalist and you're very much against this. Mm-hmm. I don't have a problem with one of two rules. If I was making the rules, I think field goals right now are too easy to make as well. I think, you know, and
you, field goals or PATs?
I think both. I
both.
Think field goal percentages now, if you're not kicking 90% on field goals,
they're ridiculous.
You stink.
I understand.
So it's become way too easy to me to make field goals in this league.
Okay.
And it's not as much of a risk. Maybe not as much as they did in the Pro Bowl. I have no problem if they want to narrow the goalposts.
Well, see, that's what I've been advocating all along.
And that's what, and I think that would make the extra point tougher. And I think it would solve two problems at the same time rather than, say, kicking the extra point from the 15-yard line.
Cool.
But you know what? I would live with that too, but I like the narrowing the goalpost idea better.
John, you have to remember when they started playing arena football and they had those nets on the sides of the goalposts and the goalposts are really, really small in the middle. That's the way they started playing arena football, and there have been a number of arena football kickers who have had tryouts in the NFL. I think only one or two of them have actually succeeded and made the NFL. I'm really, really on board with that, and I would steal that from the Arena League. Let's shrink the goalposts. I don't want to be moving the line of scrimmage for the kicks. I'm a traditionalist. You're right. I'd rather shrink the goalposts.
And, you know, I think you'll still have teams try 50-yarders when they have to, but I think you'll see more people going for it on 4th-and-1, 4th-and-2. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I remember, look, and I don't want to have, like, you know, act like I'm some kind of old man here, but I remember, you know, back in the, you know, early 90s, late 80s even, you know, hitting a 52, 53-yard kick was like,
it was a big deal.
Wow.
It was a big deal.
Wow. I can't believe they even tried that. Teams don't try. Teams routinely try those now.
You got to understand, John, in the late 60s and early 70s, and I'm certainly dating myself now, you had your better kickers in the league were making 65% on field goals.
Was it really that low?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Go back and look at your Pro Bowl kickers. You know,
they were all kicking barefoot back then, probably, right? I'm not even joking. They probably were.
No. But they were mostly straight-on guys.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, but your Stenerudes, Fred Cox, Pete Gogolak, your Mark Mosley's, and all of your old time kickers. Jim Bakken, was a great kicker with the Cardinals.
Right.
John, these guys were 65% or so, and if they kicked a 45-yarder, even that was a big deal. You know, I remember Gogolak with the Giants, could hit 40-plus yard field goals, and even though he didn't have a great percentage, the fact that he could hit a 46-yarder was a big deal.
And again, I'm not saying we need to get back to that, but I think to have 90% rates on field goals is just something you probably have to address.
The only thing that I remember about the goalposts, of course, and the old-time folks will remember how the stanchion was actually in the end zone.
Which is dangerous. I don't know how they did that.
I remember watching games with that, and I still don't understand how they got away with that all those years, because it was not only in the field of play, but it was a screen that you could use.
It was
a pick.
Sure.
Referees would always have to worry about getting around it. I still don't get how that happened. But then they finally had the intelligence to move the thing to the back line, which is like, are you kidding me? I mean, that's not easy to see.
Well, and in baseball, remember Yankee Stadium used to have Monument Park in the center field.
Yes.
It used to be on the field of play, which a lot of people don't remember.
Very well,
but,
sure.
Other things that are going to be discussed but maybe not implemented, changes on challenging procedures, maybe add a challenge for each team. And whether or not, I know the Patriots, I think, is a team that proposes this every year. They want to be able to review every single call, whether it's a penalty or anything else. So I'm sure that'll be discussed again. And I wonder, in that conversation, if they're going to talk about changing pass interference rules. Because I know that's been a discussion too, bringing it back down
it
to
15
yards. And then also, and I have an interesting theory on that pass interference idea, and then whether or not they're going to change the rules on what constitutes a catch.
And what I saw on Pro Football Talk this morning is that the rule regarding the catch, if it gets emphasized again,
it'll get tweaked, and that's it.
That's about it. It'll get emphasized. It's not necessarily going to be a wholesale change.
And I don't want to get back on my soapbox again, but I think that's a good idea. You need a defined definition of what a catch is. You can't have guys making judgment calls and different crews having different ideas. That's my opinion. I don't know if you think differently.
No, I understand. I know what it was when we were growing up, and somehow, some way, it seemed to change over the years, and I don't think it ever changed in the rule book. It just changed in terms of interpretations.
Now, here's my idea in pass interference. Since I don't want to review every penalty, because I think you're going to sit there and you're going to have a billion reviews a game, and it's going to drive people nuts.
Okay.
So, here's my idea on pass interference penalties. I think it's a play that can really change the complexion of a game.
No doubt.
So, I've always been against the college 15-yard penalty, because I didn't feel like it penalizes the defensive back enough. And I realize I'm breaking one of my cardinal rules here, because I'm going to put judgment in the hands of the officials a little bit, which I always worry about, because I think that's when you get into gray territory and you run into problems.
I understand.
But I think your defensive pass interference should either be the spot foul or 15 yards, whichever is, spot or 15, whatever's smaller. If it's like a 5-yard pass to the pass interference, it'll be a spot foul. But if it's over 15, it'll get brought down to 15. So that's stage one.
Okay.
Stage two. Now, what I always worried about is if you make it only a 15-yard penalty, you're going to have intentional pass interference down the field to prevent deep passes from being completed. There'll be takedowns and tackles and things like that.
Right.
So, much like you have a flagrant foul in basketball, I want to give the official the ability to call a personal foul pass interference penalty. If they judge what they believe is a completely intentional takedown on a deep pass where the guy doesn't play the ball at all, and it's in the air, you can tell the guy knows that he's beat, and he just out and out tackles the guy.
You're asking for trouble.
Then it's a spot foul. And I told you, I know I'm asking for trouble, but that's my little idea.
Oh, man. You know how many arguments you're going to get on that?
Oh, yeah. I do.
I mean, it's like, how do you – it's bad enough like in basketball where they have that intentional foul and it's the two shots and a ball.
I know.
You get a lot of people dealing with gray area on that. Wow, John. Here's the problem. The game has become so pass-oriented that they have forced the pass interference call to become such a huge part of the game. And it's a shame, because you never want a penalty to become such a big, important part of what you do. But it is. And I can't do the 15-yard thing. I just can't.
I would rather keep the rule the way it is than make it a uniform 15-yard penalty across the board. I'm 100% on board with. The only way I would be agreeing to that type of rule is if you have that, option on the intentional takedown to make it a spot foul. Because to me, you have to punish these guys for, you know, down the field trying to prevent a big play. But that's the last thing the NFL wants. The last thing the NFL wants are fewer big, exciting plays because guys are committing pass interference on purpose.
Right.
To get just a 15-yard penalty.
Right.
That's the last thing anybody wants.
Nobody wants that. I agree with you.
All right, let's get to the calls.
Okay.
201-939-4513. And, of course, we could talk rules, folks. We could talk about anything New York Giants, too. Whatever's on your mind, the NFL and the New York Football Giants. We want to remind you, too, vote in the MetLife Stadium top five play bracket we have going on Giants.com. It's Giants.com/NY bracket. Place your votes for the best plays in MetLife Stadium history. 201-939-4513. And that's Giants.com/NYG bracket. Let's go to Dan in Pennsylvania first. Dan, what's going on?
Hey, fellas. How you doing? Love your show. You guys are great.
Thanks, Dan.
You're welcome. Just wanted to mention, first off, I just wanted to put out there that my wife and I, season ticket holders, and we just can't get enough of our Giants. Just breathe it and live it all year round.
Thanks,
and,
Dan.
And just wanted to put that out there. But I wanted to touch on what Paul mentioned, Paul, what you had mentioned last week. And I know you don't want to sugarcoat anything. You're going to tell it like it is and be honest, which we all appreciate. You had mentioned, which is definitely, I agree with you, but I just want to discuss it. You had said that we still have a lot of needs, which is
pretty
definitely
obvious.
True.
Pretty obvious.
Right, but I think, I know last year we went, you know, we were so active with the free agency last year, not as much this year, but you know, we tried to make fill in those holes last year, you know, and we the one thing that fell apart on us was when Schwartz got hurt. But as far as this year now, as far as what we're good at, I mean, where I think we're pretty good at, I mean, our defense, our DBs, I think we're pretty okay. Our defensive line, we've picked up a couple of guys. I think, you know,
Can I stop you just 1 second, though, because you glossed over the DBs. Last time I checked, there's not a lot of experience at safety on this roster.
Right. I was going to mention safety. You're right. I was kind of just putting the cornerbacks
okay.
in my head. But the safety I was definitely going to touch on as far as what our needs are.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's no question that you're looking at the two most experienced corners on the roster now being Cooper Taylor and Nat Burhe. And you know, as much as the Giants probably want to believe that Nat Burhe, when they drafted him last year, they had some high hopes for him. As much as they may want him to compete for a starting job, and maybe he'll win one, you still need two safeties to start. And I don't know if you got two starters right there.
And by the way, and Paul, I'm happy you said the word compete, because I feel like a lot of people out there are just reflexively handing a starting job to Nat Burhe. Like, oh, it's a second-year pro. He can be a starter. No. He's going to have to earn the starting job by playing well in the spring. Go ahead, Dan. Finish up.
Right, and I was going to touch on definitely that the safety we needed. Our defensive line, we've picked up a couple of guys, so, you know, that's improved. And our linebackers, you know, we picked up a couple, Thomas and Casillas, to go along with Kennard, Beeson, McClain. And who knows if we, you know, I know that's not perfect, especially with injuries. But, you know, I think on the defensive line, except for the safety position, we're pretty good. On the offensive side, I'm going to definitely give you time to tweak it. I know that. On the offensive side, I know running backs were, you know, of course, we got to worry about injuries. But running backs were looking good. Wide receiver, hopefully Cruz comes back really well. And we got that. Quarterback, we know we're good. Of course, it's the offensive line. Now, do you think, like, outside of the offensive line and the safety position, we're hurting in any other area greatly, or is it just mainly, I think, the offensive line, I mean, that's our backbone. We got to, you know, that's our main thing.
The thing I think that you want to look at from the acquisitions they've made over the course of the last month, they've helped themselves primarily in depth purposes. Now, Vereen's going to have a big role in this offense.
Absolutely.
I mean, there's no question. He's a key third down cog here. But the rest of the guys were really depth guys, and they've done a very good job of kind of smoothing out a bunch of potholes on different areas of the roster. But if you're looking at the glaring needs, to me, safety's clearly one of them. You mentioned the offensive line. There's no question about that. I harp on that every single season. And then the other one, to me, has got to be tight end, because I understand that the receiving production that they got last year, I mean, I'm not going to argue with 60-plus catches. That's nice.
And seven, eight touchdowns. Whatever
I mean, Larry Donnell did some nice things in the passing game. But you know what? He's not a really good blocking tight end, and I don't know that he's got it in him. And, you know, they've re-signed Daniel Fells with the hope that he can compete, and perhaps he may wind up being the number two guy again. But to me, if they can get a stud blocking tight end by the time they get to training camp, maybe that guy should be the number three, or maybe he competes and beats out Fells and becomes the number two. But you can't have the type of consistent power running game, John, that I know Coach Coughlin would like to have unless you know you can count on a tight end who's going to stick his nose right in the middle of the business there on a third and one and help knock back a defensive end or a linebacker.
Thanks, Dan. Appreciate it. All right. I agree. I think linebacker is interesting because, like you said, they added depth. I guess if Beeson's healthy, they have their three starters in hand. If he's not, we'll see what they do.
Right.
I mean, I think their acquisition from the Jaguars can certainly step in there. J.T. Thomas, obviously, can step in there and do that job. And I think he could even be a starter on the outside, depending on how things go on down the road, too. How about this one for you? And we haven't talked about this a lot since the signing happened. How about slot corner? That is a virtual starting spot.
Yeah, I'm a big Tremaine McBride fan.
Can he stay healthy?
I wouldn't be surprised. You know, they re-signed Shockey Brown to kind of help themselves at that spot. And by the way, Stevie Brown is still unsigned, but I understand his foot rehab is going well. I would still put him back in the mix as potentially coming back here to help out the safety spot. John, at some point, you have to believe they'll bring in another corner for competition purposes at the very least. I'm not necessarily thinking they're going to sign someone now who's good enough to be the immediate answer. But you're right. I mean, they're going to need more corners to compete in August. There's no question about that.
Especially with history here in terms of corners.
Oh.
You need to have like 13 of them.
Have you ever seen in the last 3 years, I think that position has been more snake bitten than any position I've seen in 32 years, now 33 years of covering Giants football. I can't get over what has happened to these corners, John.
201-939-4513. Russell's in Fort Knox net. Russell, what's up?
Man, what's going on? How was your weekend?
Doing well, Russ. How are you?
Yeah, boy, blocking tight end. That's what I was about to bring up. Every time I hear blocking tight end, I know it's you talking about it. Like, I got two questions. Like, they say the Giants picked the best player at number 9. Now, here's the wrinkle effect I keep telling about this draft. Marcus Mariota. At 9, he's going to be there. I just got a big feeling. If the Jets don't draft him, he will be there at 9. Will you think the Giants will trade the Browns, who's needing a quarterback? Think the Giants will trade that draft pick to the Browns?
I don't think first of all, as bad as it's been with him, I don't think the Browns are ready to jump ship on their first-round pick from last year and jump on another spread offense guy coming out this year to be another project quarterback. So,
I understand what you're saying.
Maybe the Rams.
They were about to trade their first-round pick for Sam Bradford, the Chip Kelly. They was about to do it. That's how bad they want a quarterback. I was like, man, I'm looking at this like they crazy to do that. And the second thing I wanted to ask y'all, now you're saying we're saying offensive line. I think the Giants going to go offensive line. I think they have no choice. What is the best offensive line out the draft that you think will fit the Giants? The kid from LSU, the kid from Stanford, or the kid from Iowa?
Well, Scherf is the guy from Iowa who is universally regarded as the premier offensive line prospect in this draft. But again, there are some teams who think he's going to be a better guard, other teams who think he's going to be a better tackle. I'm going to tell you right now, I don't know what Jerry Reese thinks. He has not confided in me.
Thank God.
And I think that's a key point to take into account because you know that tackles are higher on value boards, and rightfully so, than guards are. So if Scherf is a guard, is he truly worth the number 9 overall pick?
Yeah,
I'm not sure.
Russell, I'll say this. I think the two guys, from what I've seen, I don't think Lael Collins is the guy that'll slip into the top 10. He's the kid at LSU, I'm assuming you're talking about. Pete is the only other guy, the kid from Stanford, the third one you mentioned, that I've seen. I think Kuiper has him going to the Giants in his latest mock draft at 9. So I could, you know, I could visualize Pete or Scherf at 9 based on what I'm seeing from the way a lot of people are evaluating these prospects. I think Collins at 9 might be a little bit of a stretch.
I agree with John on that. And the thing with Pete is more people think that he's going to have to grow into that value, that he's more of a potential guy.
He's 6'7", right, Pete? He's a big dude, right?
Yeah, but he needs to put on more on his frame. And so there may be more long-term potential in Pete, but immediately – It looks like Scherff is the best guy, you know, in terms of value. I will add this, though, and we talked about this a lot last week, John, while you were away on vacation. If the Giants get a bunch of phone calls at number nine when they're on the clock, and if they aren't 1,000% convinced that one of those offensive linemen is worthy of a nine value, I could see them moving back two or three spots. It could happen. Mm-hmm. I could see them moving back to the mid-teens.
All right. Yeah, have a good day.
Appreciate it, Russell. Well, I want to talk about that for a second. Let's talk about the concept of trading back here before we get to our busy phones. It's something I would definitely look at. Look, the Giants right now are in a position. They're coming off two seasons where they haven't been to the playoffs. I'm not telling anybody anything they don't already know. And you need as many talented players on this team as possible. Mm-hmm. If you don't think the drop-off in talent, and this is, again, in a theoretical world, I don't, much like Paul said, we don't know what the Giants scouts of front office are thinking. And frankly, they haven't even consolidated their own information yet to put their draft board together. So nobody knows yet. But if they decide that who they have available to them at nine isn't going to be that much difference talent-wise that who's going to be available at 15. And look, sometimes you'll have five or six guys in a row that have very similar grades. It's not going to be that much of a shift. It happens depending on the year. I don't have a problem with trading down to pick up an extra two or an extra three. Go for it. Why not?
Where it becomes very interesting, and we had a couple of calls ask about this too, John, is what if one of those two stud receivers drops to nine? And I think it's pretty likely that at least one of them will be there at nine. Then the Giants go back to last year's dilemma and say, look, this wide receiver is so highly rated on the board.
Right.
He should have been a top five guy. You know, we think he's so much better than the cluster. Do you take him like they took Beckham last year? Or at that point, do you start picking up that phone call or that's going to be coming in? Because they're going to be a bunch.
Right.
There will be people who are going to want Cooper or White. If one of those receivers or both of them drop, you will get
calls. Both won't. But I think there's a decent shot one of them is going to be there.
And so now you got to answer those phone calls, and you got to see what those folks are offering. And you'll be in a position of leverage right there if you're the Giants, because you know that even though – at least one of those receivers, if he's there, is going to be a super prospect. You also know that, you know what, we really could maybe do a good deal here and get a number two.
Well, and heck, Paul, one of those final remaining three, four outside linebacking pass rushers might be there at nine that somebody else wants to jump up and get. Pass rushers are hard to find in this league. If somebody really wants one of those guys, that could be an opportunity too.
Lord knows why so many teams love these tweeners. But God bless him, because there's a bunch of them in this draft.
If you're a 3-4 team,
yeah,
you want a 250-pound guy to rush off the edge. That's what it's designed for.
You like those guys.
Right.
And that they fit your system a lot better. Again, me, traditionalist, I don't want any one of those guys. But you're right. There will be some teams that are going to be very attracted to them.
Though if it was 1988 and the Giants were in a 3-4 defense, you wouldn't mind someone lining up an outside linebacker rushing the passer at 250?
I got LT and Banks. I don't need anybody.
Well, shut up. 201-939-4513. Let's go out all the way to Wisconsin and say what's up to Lance. Lance, what's going on?
Hi.
What's up, Lance?
I have a statement and two questions. Quick questions.
Go ahead.
You guys mentioned that Landon Collins going at nine was too high.
No, Lael Collins, the offensive lineman. But in fairness, I also think Landon Collins at nine is also too high.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of folks say he maybe sneaks into the top ten, but I don't think that's going to happen.
I talked about it with Paul and John on Friday. But actually, I believe Antrell Roll was in the top ten when he was drafted.
Remember, he was drafted as a cornerback, though, Lance. When he got drafted out of college, he was considered a corner. He got moved to safety a couple years later.
Correct.
You did?
Yep.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
And my question is, John and Paul, John, you go first. Who do you think the Giants will draft?
I will say right now, I will still reserve the right to change my mind on this, but based on what the Giants have done before, and again, it depends who's on the board too, I think you're looking at either an offensive lineman or defensive lineman. If I had to guess now, and that's all it is, Lance, I got to be honest with you, it's a guess. It depends who's there. Paul, do you have anything on the tip of your tongue?
I'm going to go to Scherff at this point, but again, I'm reserving the right to change it as well. But that's where I'm going to go, because I am partial to the offensive line, which I still think needs more fortification. I'm not nearly as strong on that pick as I was on Zach Martin last year, which, you know, I was really strong for. I'm going to say, with a lightly treading on water, I'm going for Scherff right now.
I'm going to take a guess here, Lance. And just because to me, Scherf doesn't profile as the type of people you've seen the Giants pick in the first round during Jerry Reese's tenure here, or at least not that high in the first round in the top 10. But again, maybe he just hasn't worked right. Jerry Reese always says he wants to take the best player available, and I believe if he thinks Brandon Scherf's that guy, he would take him. I'm going to go with the big defensive tackle, Shelton, out of Washington. And it's just a guess.
That's what I was guessing, too. One more question.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys know this, but who's the first regular season opponent for 2015?
That has not been announced yet, Lance.
And when will it be announced?
Probably third week of April, give or take.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, bud.
Bye.
I think a week before that, John, the NFL usually gets its preseason skit out there. Yeah. So we'll at least get a taste of some of the things that we'll see before the season. The one thing, John, I do think that the Kenrick Ellis was a good signing by the Giants.
By the way, I think that was an excellent signing. It's a run-stuffing defensive tackle. I think he fits a definite role on this team. I agree.
He's a plugger. You know, and he takes over the role that Sean Rogers was supposed to have when he got here a few years ago. And that's why, to be honest, I'm certainly much less anxious to be drafting a defensive tackle than I would have been a week ago.
But that's not a plugger, though. Shelton's not a plugger. He's a guy that can be, you know.
He's 345.
Yeah, but he's agile.
6'4", 345.
But he's agile.
I look at him more as – I think they'll use him as a plugger. We haven't talked to Spags.
Yeah, but again,
I don't know, use him as
a plugger, but that doesn't mean he can't also penetrate and do more at that line than just stop the run.
You know, I'm looking forward to seeing him, let's put it that way. And at least now they have a body who fits that dimension to me that makes it less of a need to draft one of those guys at 9. That's my opinion.
I agree. 201-939-4513. Back to the phones. And again, I think Scherf is an excellent pick. I just kind of wanted to be a little bit different. But there you go. Who knows what's going to happen? It's a long way to go.
I may move off of that before we get to the draft. I could. I don't know that I will, but I could.
Let's go to Jeff in Rhode Island coming up next. Jeff, what's going on, buddy?
Hey, good afternoon, guys.
Hi,
How's
Jeff.
The week off, Johnny?
Nice and relaxing, Jeff. I'm happy to be back, though. Get back in the saddle.
Oh, that's good. I had to laugh to myself Friday afternoon show when I looked at the bracketology for the greatest game ever played at or play at MetLife Stadium. And what did I see? But it's about time with Travis Beckham. I couldn't believe it was on there.
The IAT, baby.
It was an interesting play.
Now, Paul, the backstory to that, that was the year that Lance and I played a game on our Monday show. We always host it on Monday after the game.
Okay.
And we had fans, we picked a play from the game, we had fans call in and name the play. You know, give like a name to the play.
Oh, okay.
So Jeff calls in and he goes, guys, the Beckham play. We're going to call it the IAT. And we're like, IAT, Jeff, what does that mean? He goes, it's about time.
Oh, mighty. Okay.
I thought it was funny.
I guess I understand where you're coming from.
Yeah, it was funny. It still is funny. I'm glad we're still getting some mileage out of it.
Hey, it was a highlight.
About,
let's give him credit for
Giants
that.
Giants picking up this guy, Selvey. You think he's got anything to offer, the guy from the Cowboys?
You know, I think Selvey, much like Ellis, is a solid pickup. If you look at his run grades from Pro Football Focus the last couple of years, he's very solid against the run. He's not going to be a dynamic pass rusher, you know, that's going to get you double-digit sacks. But he'll be solid off that edge. He had six or seven sacks a couple of years ago. I think he'll stop the run well. I think he's a good rotational guy that'll help the Giants in the defensive line.
One of those depth guys we talked about just a few moments ago, and that's where he fits in. Remember, Kiwanuka is now gone and in all likelihood will retire. So that's what they get with him. You know, it's funny, the other day we were talking about him when he got here, and I had remembered him being here at camp. Well, it was actually mini camp. It wasn't the summer camp that he was at a few years ago. So he was only here for a couple of days. He didn't do anything that stuck out to me when he was here. And then, of course, he wound up going to Dallas and had 7 sacks that first year with the Cowboys, although I understand that they were gift sacks. They weren't necessarily sacks that he went to get. They were sacks where the quarterback either got sucked into him on a roll or because somebody else like DeMarcus Ware was pressuring a guy into him. And so that 7 sack number is a little deceiving. He's not really a pass rusher. He's more a stay-at-home run-stopping guy. which I don't have a problem with. The Giants could use one of those guys.
Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay, guys, you have a good day now. Talk to you soon.
Appreciate it, Jeff. Okay. Well, just to go back for, just to
what do you got?
Get the idea here. Let's see. By team. Just look at Pro Football Focus's numbers for him as a 4-3 defensive end in 2013. That's the year, like you mentioned, he had those sacks. But a lot of them were fortunate ones where he got a little bit lucky. Let's see if he's even on.
Yeah, I was told that many of them were gift wrapped, and that's why there's a huge spike in his sack total that season.
Yeah, you know what? He is a negative 4.5 grade rushing the passer that year, despite the fact he has those sacks. So that's probably the case.
Then okay, take that for what it's worth.
201-939-4503. He did grade very positively against the run both those years. So
That's what he does. And you know what? The other thing is we talked about last week, too. Sometimes when you get these friendly rivalries of guys who were teammates in college, it helps spark them on a little bit. And him and JPP, of course, knew each other very well and worked together in unison one year at South Florida.
Speaking of pass rushers, what did you think of the Greg Hardy to Cowboys signing?
Wow. You know, I think, you know, Jerry Jones to me is in a situation where I don't want to say he's in a term of panic. That may be a strong word to use, but I think he's saying to himself, Tony Romo's getting on in years. He's had some injuries. We've spent a lot of money. We've now had to reshuffle our running back situation because we couldn't afford DeMarco Murray.
Well, they could have afforded him. They chose not to invest amount of money in the running back.
Because they tagged Dez.
Well, but if they could pay Greg Hardy, they could have paid DeMarco Murray if they wanted to.
Okay, fair enough. But he's now in a situation, I think this is certainly a win-now move.
Oh, well, it's only a one-year deal. It better be a win-now move.
There's no doubt. There's no doubt. The money they're spending on him, it's a win-now move, and he's taking a chance on a guy who certainly has got some baggage.
Now, it is interesting, though, the way they designed the contract, I thought, where this is not guaranteed money. He's basically getting $500,000 check for every game he's on the 53, so they're protecting themselves from a potential suspension.
Which is intelligent, no question.
Right. So I just thought it was interesting. And look, the Cowboys' pass rush was awful last year. They couldn't get to the quarterback. You saw it in the playoffs. One of the reasons they lost to the Packers. And Hardy, you know, let's be honest, pass rushers like him don't become available. Why? Because of things like the franchise tag. Look at Jason Pierre-Paul. So they know they had to improve the defense, and they sacrificed some of their offense with DeMarco Murray to try to get the defense better. Though pairing him with Rod Marinelli is a little bit scary because he's an excellent defensive line coach.
Nobody would argue that, you know. So, hey, this whole division right now is a huge question mark to me.
And by the way, how responsible have the Redskins been this offseason? It's been very un-Redskins-like offseason for them.
Yeah. I don't know that they're that good. And I certainly don't know what their quarterback situation looks like.
I never said they were very good. I just said they didn't go crazy and pay a lot of people in free agency.
Okay, that's fair.
That's all I was saying.
That's fair. I still think they're the bottom of the division.
I agree.
But the other three teams, certainly the Eagles and Cowboys have been much more aggressive in juggling their lineups than the Giants have been.
Well, the Eagles have been more aggressive than anybody in juggling their lineups. I mean, the Cowboys have been relatively quiet.
Yes, yes. So, I mean, what I'm looking here, I'm looking at a division that I can't handicap yet. I just can't do it.
Too hard. 201-939-4513, hashtag Giants Chat. By the way, I want to remind you guys again, go to our special MetLife Stadium bracket. You can vote for the best plays in MetLife Stadium history. It's the 5th-year anniversary of the stadium. Go to Giants.com/NYG bracket to place your votes. Back to the phones. Ryan in New Jersey has been waiting the longest. Ryan, what's going on, pal?
How you doing, sir? How you day going?
Great, Ryan. How are you?
Hi.
Not bad. Hey, two questions for you. One, why does everybody and their mother seem to think Justin Pugh is a better guard than he is tackle? I think he played pretty well at tackle over the last 2 years. I don't know why people that don't even watch football are telling me this guy's a better tackle guard.
Well, Ryan, here's
the
thing.
And I don't know what translates in his game to make him a better guard.
Ryan, I will tell you, literally, and this is the only reason, people think he's going to be a better guard than they are tackle. Because when Justin Pugh got drafted, these draft experts, the Mel Kipers, the Todd McShays, and all those guys, you know, list them. All of them said, Justin Pugh's arms are too short. He can't play tackle. He projects better, and he projects better as a guard. That is the only plausible reason anybody would think that he's a better guard than a tackle, because that's what people said when he got drafted. There is no physical evidence or proof, because he's never, ever, ever, never, ever, never, ever played guard in his entire NFL or collegiate career at guard. He's never played there. So, no, there's nobody out there that knows he'll be better at guard than he is a tackle. Could he be? Sure. I don't know either way because I've never seen him play there before, but that's why people tend to think that.
Okay, so Mel Kiper ruined it for everybody.
Yeah,
I got
pretty
you.
Much. Yeah.
I should only chime in here because I'm one of the guys who has said that. I would say from an athletic standpoint, he is very pliable. He is very, very athletic in the lower body. And guards, when they pull out and they swing outside of a tackle to get that block off of the edge, that he has the body type to do that extremely well.
But does he have the power to anchor and push at the guard?
Well, and see,
true.
Now
I mean,
that,
I remember that, when I think it was Sean Andrews was here from the Eagles when we got him. He was a mountain of a man, and he would just push the pile. And that's really my ideal of a prototypical guard. I know that.
Well, here's the thing.
Was like, you know, 30 pounds lighter than
here's
he
the
was
thing.
At that point.
Usually, when they talk about your tackles, not only do they have to have great technique. And they do have to have some footwork on the outside to deal with speed pass rushers.
And lateral quickness side to side.
No question. But they need to have also more power. And Justin Pugh, if there's one thing that he's going to have to do if he stays at right tackle, is get stronger.
I agree.
He needs more power at the point of attack.
Well, frankly, I think wherever he plays, though, he has to get a little stronger.
I think they'd like that from him no matter what.
Right.
But especially if they're going to keep him at tackle. Because the Giants have used some zone blocking schemes now in the last couple of years.
Yep.
And what happens is, if he's playing guard, are you all right?
I'm good. Yep, I'm fine.
Okay, just checking on you there. It sounded like you were choking or something. The reason that we talk about him at guard is because even though you like to have big, powerful guys at guard to push the pile, there is that element of being able to get out to the outside, which he has the athleticism to do.
I agree with
and
that.
And a lot of 300-pound guys can't do that. So that's the primary reason.
But I would say the reason a lot of lay people who maybe don't watch things as closely as you that is because of what the analysis was when he got drafted.
I get it.
Okay. And one more question real quick. To piggyback off of you, talking about needing to get stronger. Do you think that DeMontre Moore, I know he's like a 250-pound guy, do you think he has the physical abilities to be that every down defensive end, like a straight hand OC or JPP.
Well, Ryan,
is he body type going to be strictly like a pass rushing?
I think we're gonna find out this year, and I think that's really the question that needs to get answered. And I don't have the answer. I talked to him about it last year. I think I interviewed him for our radio pregame show around week 13 or 14 or something like that. And I asked him, I go, DeMontre, I know one of your goals is to try to put on weight. And he goes, John, I know. I've been trying to do that for 2 years. I got up to like 250. I got up to like 255 in the offseason. It was great. And then I started going to training camp and I started practicing, started playing in games. And I blinked my eyes. I was back into the high 240s again. He goes, I eat all the time, but my body will not allow me to keep weight on. So it's one of those deals where he's trying to put on weight, but you're right. He just might not have that body type where he can maintain a 265, 270-pound frame at defensive end. He might not be able to do it. He wants to. He knows that's what he has to do. But I'm not sure if he can, Ryan. I think this is going to be the year where we're like, all right, he can do it, or no, he can't. We're going to find out in the spring when he gets here.
Ryan, you want to help him out, open up a really good home-style Italian restaurant down from his block. That's what he needs. Because this man needs to eat, and he needs to eat a lot. But seriously, all right, seriously, though, remember when Strahan finally played his last couple of years here before he retired, he was down about 255, but the difference was he had tremendous power.
Yes.
Especially for his frame, and he really knew how to use his leverage and his technique. DeMontre Moore not only is not strong for his frame, he needs to increase his power quotient.
Agreed.
In addition to that, he could use more beef. And then the other thing is DeMontre Moore has been a little slow in terms of that maturing process. He doesn't know all of the great techniques that he should be able to use. And now this is third year, John. It's time to show up. Remember, he came out a year early. So he is on the younger side. His development needs to happen now. All right, it's no more time to wait here.
Thanks, Ryan.
You're welcome. Thank you, guys.
Appreciate it. And I think, Strand's a good example. But I think if you want to model his game after anybody that's been here, model after Osi. If he's going to be anything, he's going to be a speed rusher off the edge. That's going to be his strength.
There's no question. And that's where he can make the most impact.
Yeah.
But even that, remember, OC played at 260, 265. Yep. In fact, at one point, I think OC was even 270.
Yeah, but right now, DeMontre Moore, the way he's built, and again, this is everyone's said this before. We're not saying anything anybody hasn't already said publicly. You know, he's a tweener size right now. He's one of those guys that's coming out in the draft that's a 3-4 stand-up outside linebacker. Can he become that consistent guy and get strong enough? And again, when I say put on weight, I don't mean put on fat. I mean put on good weight,
right.
Put on muscle. We got to see if he can do it.
You mentioned earlier, I think one of the callers brought up Selvey. Selvey's like 6'3 and a half, 6'4, 270.
270.
He's a legit
4'3
defensive end who stops the run.
A left end. That's why he's a left end that stops the run to go up against those powerful right tackles that you're talking about.
And Justin Tuck. Again, similar body type.
Yep.
Justin Tuck was no 250. Yep. He was a 270.
Robert Ayers.
Robert Ayers, another guy. You talk about, here's the bottom line. The bottom line is, no matter what style of defensive end you are, you better have a high power quotient. Because, John, if you don't, those offensive linemen nowadays, they will toss you.
They will.
And that's the end of that.
All right, here we go. Two more calls before we say goodbye. Let's go to Mike in Florida next. Mike, what's up?
Hey, how y'all doing?
Doing well, Mike. What's up?
Hi.
Okay, I just wanted to know, you guys, hear anything about safety? So, who we bringing? Because I don't think we're going to be able to do with Nat Burry
Cooper Taylor. Cooper.
Yeah, it's not, we're in trouble. That was our problem last year, like the middle of the field on defense, at linebacker and safety.
Mike, right now, all is quiet on the Western Front. I'm sure the Giants are working on it. The front office is working hard to fill that spot and bring in some people at that position, but so far there is nothing to report.
Now, last week while John was away, and I implore you to do the same thing, Paul Schwartz of the Post had a good story. He caught up with Nat Burhey. And asked him about, what's going on here? And Nat was extremely confident, as he should be, in his skills, believing that the taste of the NFL that he had last year, albeit on special teams, was enough to make him believe that he could not only compete for that job, but win that job. And so, take a look at the article. I don't think there's any question, John, that Burry's got some skills. Now, can he be the guy? I think we're going to find out. You know, he's going to have to win it.
I just hope so, because, it's just not going to be, that's the problem that we had last year, though. Last year, we had a problem in the middle of the field. And
remember,
then
missile. They called him the missile when he was in college, and he played a lot of in-the-box safety as a third safety guy who came up and helped support the run. So if they play him at strong safety, that's not a reach. That's what he can do. At least in theory.
I got to add up one more thing about Joe Selvey. Did you guys know that George and Jason Pierre-Paul is like the only three Haitian that we have on the team? So they really know each other though. Him, Clamati, and George was like three Haitian that we have on the
field. I don't know about their backgrounds there, but I do know that JPP and Selvey were teammates at South Florida.
Yeah.
And, of course, remember, it was Steve Spagnuolo who drafted Selvey out of college when he was with the Rams in the seventh round 2010.
Yeah, right, yeah. So, we'll see what happened, though, because, he really liked Jason, and Jason really liked him, though. So we'll work together. So hopefully we'll see what happens.
Good stuff.
Appreciate it.
All right, now.
Thanks, Mike. 201-939-4513. Brian in Philly wraps us up. Brian, what's up?
Hello?
You there, pal? I had the right caller, right? Is Brian? Oh, Gary in Philly. I'm sorry, Gary. Go ahead, man. My bad. I had the wrong name.
Hey, how you doing?
Sorry about that, pal.
Good. Quick question, because I've been seeing all morning. And maybe somebody asked a question. I haven't been on the phone that long. What's going on here with Eli? They're talking about they don't want to, they can't come to terms, and they're going to let him play out his last year.
No. No one has said that from either Eli's camp or the Giants' camp. There was a mention by one of the media reporters that he was suggesting Eli would play out his contract and nothing would happen before then. John, I think you and I have both said very, very, very many times, animately here, unless there is a serious injury that derails Eli Manning's career, He's going to retire a Giant, and he's going to be here for many, many years.
I think so.
I mean, the date of him signing an extension or a new deal, whether or not it's this week, next week, 3 months from now, or 6 months from now, until the Giants are desperate for cap room, and they need to make a move that then can alter their cap number, there's no reason to do that. And, you know, anything else that you hear, as far as I'm concerned, is just shooting smoke to the wind.
Okay, that's great. I mean, I saw him from three different writers.
You have to understand something, too. Once something gets out on the air or gets up on the web, everybody starts running with it and repeating it many, many times over.
Hey, look, and Gary, here's the other thing, too, is that neither the Giants, you know, or Eli Manning in his camp, neither one is made up of a side that's going to leak a lot of stuff. So for all we know, there could be some type of progress in their negotiations, and nobody talks about it because they don't leak that type of information. You know, nobody really knows where that is right now. I think there's a lot of assumptions being made. You know, the same way you hear a lot of reports and assumptions about Phillip Rivers and his one-year contract with the Chargers. You hear the same thing from that side. So I think it's just a lot of people, frankly, trying to figure out something to talk about in April. I'm serious. In March, nothing's happened yet. Yeah. And Eli Manning is the biggest name on the team. He's going to the last year of his contract, so it's something that'll get clicks. So they write about it because they're getting clicks, when the reality is that nobody really has any idea what's going on between Eli Manning and the team right now and where the negotiations are and where either side is at. So I think that's a wait-and-see proposition. The bottom line are Eli wants to be here, and John Mara wants Eli here. So that's those are the two most important facts that you should worry
about,
Gary.
Absolutely agree.
Right. Thank you so much for answering the question.
No problem. Thanks for calling in, Gary. Thanks for listening.
Right. You know, it's very interesting, John. Many quarterbacks have some of their, at least in the last decade or two, some of their premier years in their late 30s and almost going on to 40, you know. And so that's why when I look at Eli, although he's been so durable and taken so many hits, God knows we know how many hits he's taken. We've seen them firsthand. I believe that it's not unrealistic to expect him to play for another 4, 5, 6 years. Now, maybe he'll only be at a high level for another 2 or 3, but maybe he can do it for 4, 5, or 6.
I would expect another 4 to 5 years of pretty strong play.
I'm Pro Bowl caliber play? I don't know, but I'll say this. I see no reason why he couldn't be a starter another 5 or 6 years down the road.
I don't see a guy, you know, I like Ryan Nassib. I think he showed a lot of improvement last year, but I don't think you see a guy that's ready to take over and play at the same level that he played at last year.
Right, I understand. No, look, Eli Manning, folks, in case nobody's looked at the numbers recently, Eli Manning really did have a Pro Bowl caliber season
last year.
I think that he was truly sensational, and it got overlooked because the team did not have as much success as they wanted to.
All right, Paul.
What do you got?
Very briefly, when I was on vacation last week, I was in Las Vegas, for those that don't know.
Okay.
And for a very brief moment or two.
Yes.
I thought of Paul DeTino.
Uh-oh.
So, have you ever been to Las Vegas?
When Robert Morris won.
Well, that was one, actually.
Oh, that was great. Go NEC. Northeast Conference, baby.
Beat North Florida, which is a nice win in the playing game. Then they had to play Julia Okafor, and that didn't go so well.
No.
But Andy Tuhl did a great job down there.
He did.
Now, have you ever been to Las Vegas?
Never.
Now, the way you navigate Las Vegas on the Strip is that there's a ton of walking. You have to walk a lot from casino to casino to go across the street and things like that. And I feel like you would get excited about all the walking.
Would love it.
The congestion, I feel like, and the people on the streets that try to either solicit you to, you know, buy their products or go to certain places with their cards, I think that would really bother you. And I'm not sure you would handle that well because you really dislike New Orleans. You didn't like walking around New Orleans, right?
Did not.
Vegas is like that times 5.
Oh, not good.
I don't think you would handle it well.
No.
You would like the weather, though, because when it was snowing here on Friday, I was in my shorts outside watching college basketball.
I would concur with that part of your statement without question. But you are right because, you know, when I'm going, almost 4 miles an hour on my power walks, I can't have a lot of people congestion.
No, I know. That's what I was saying. I was thinking you would be, like, running these poor, you know, people over on the Strip and, like, knocking them down.
Yeah.
I don't think that would go well.
No. I think there would be people upset with me.
And I think you would be upset with other people.
I would be.
Though I could see a short-lived Paul DeTino one-man show, like, you know, at some very small casino maybe in downtown Vegas, where it's, you know, come see Paul DeTino's, you know, Giants monologues for like 45 minutes at a time.
Yeah, or we could just go over old tapes.
That would be part of the show. Very, very quickly on the tweets.
Did you have a couple we wanted to throw out there?
I did. I see one from David Goodman.
Okay, go ahead.
This is him talking about DeMontre Moore. OC knew, Spags knew OC was not good against the run, but he knew how to use him. He'll do the same with DeMontre Moore. Every time Moore got on the field, he generated pressure on the passer, which is not true, by the way. He was inconsistent rushing the passer. He made a couple plays here and there, but he was inconsistent.
Yes.
Field didn't think that was important. We had problems in the middle largely because Roll was awful, yet people wanted to bring him back. I don't think Roll was awful last year. Roll was trying to make up for a lot of other people that weren't on the field. So that was on Moore. Felipe Finger, if NYG draft a stud linebacker, say in round one or two, and he dominates in camp, who do you see now as being cut? Herzlick, McLean, other? I'm not sure you have to cut any of the guys. I think they're good special teamers.
Well, the other thing, I hate to say this, but injuries sometimes play a role in that, and we know how the Giants have had a lot of guys hurt the last couple of years.
Let's see. Tremaine Anderson wants you to give up on the Zach Martin thing. I agree with that.
You know, the problem is that whole story won't probably die until after this year's draft. Then it can go away. But as long as we keep talking about the draft, you know, there'll be thoughts about what happened last year and how things went down. And so the name will come up. But you're right. It's not something we need to beat to death.
Thank you, Paulie.
That's it. We're done.
See you next time. Tomorrow afternoon, Giants.com. New, another episode of Big Blue Kickoff Live. Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Come on, man. We need the work. Let's go. Let's go.
Down the middle of the field. He's got through. 35, 30.
Want to get no punt. Close the intercept.